Hello, I'm Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. There's a new marriage taking place in academia. Fields of studies traditionally isolated from one another are now working to make essential interdisciplinary links. A well-known living example is Spanish architect and engineer Santiago Calatrava. He's said to be one of the greatest and most innovative architects alive, placing architecture in the context of his art where nature meets engineering. Stanford Anderson, former head of architecture at MIT, describes him as unabashedly pursuing the unity of art and science. His exploration of natural forms, his readiness to work metaphorically, and his brilliance in representation all facilitate his creative exploration of form, space, light, and even kinetics. His mastery of engineering principles not only allows the realization of his designs, but is challenged and advanced by the dialogue between formal invention and scientific principles. It is this kind of marriage between architecture and engineering that researchers in the UBC Faculty of Applied Science are also working to achieve. Today I speak with Dr. Taysir Abunasser, Dean of Applied Science, who shares her vision to lead an extraordinary faculty ready to exchange ideas and build vital alliances. This is Prof Talk. Dr. Abunasser, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. You have been recently appointed in the Faculty of Applied Science, but you have deep roots in engineering, going back to your undergraduate days where you completed a bachelor's degree in engineering. What first motivated you to first study engineering, and what continues to excite you about the field? I mean, that is a big question,
yeah,
I know.
And you're thinking back a quarter of a century away. I don't know. I liked engineering. I liked the thought process that goes into it. I like the problem solving skills. I don't think I really had the big picture of engineering then, but I was good in math and sciences, and that seemed like the natural choice. I knew I liked engineering a whole lot more than medicine. That I knew, so that I had the choice between the two, and at the time, I decided I just would not handle the responsibility of having people's lives in my hands. I just thought that would be too much. Little did I know that when you go into engineering, you do have people's lives in your hands in a different way. But it was something that just was from high school. The two options I had that I personally was thinking of were either engineering or, strangely enough, journalism. These were the two that I had. But once you settle that, and that was not such a big decision, because I knew I could be in engineering and I could write if I want to, but if I went into journalism, I couldn't do engineering on the side. So that was the easier one. Medicine was the one that was pressure. There was a lot of pressure to go into it, and that for me was not something that I would handle myself.
Right. And now you've spent a lot of your time in Ontario. You did all of your graduate studies there. What brought you to UBC? And how has your transition to the West Coast been?
Well, what brought me to UBC is a very long story, but to make it extremely short is the mission statement, the vision statement of UBC. And that's the part that really started to get me to seriously consider the possibility of moving. When they were first trying to get me to consider it, I really did not want to leave Ottawa, because for me, I had very, very, very deep roots in Ottawa, and I had gotten to be quite involved in a lot of things, and I simply would not consider leaving the city, no matter what. And when after some discussions, when I read the vision statement of it, because of the fact that what was attracting me in Ottawa at the time was a lot of stuff that I was doing outside the university, within the community, that would you come to a certain age where you start saying there is more to life than the specific things that we all go after in jobs and things like that, that you can actually impact and make a difference in other things. When I read the vision statement of UBC, and it was talking about educating, it was talking about the goal of UBC being educating global citizens who promote the values of a civil and sustainable society. It was not talking about excellence. It was not talking about being number one. It was talking about making a difference in society. And then when you read it carefully, you realize that, of course, they are talking about excellence, but they are talking about excellence as a tool rather than as an objective. And that part, for me, flipped the whole equation. And rather than saying, why should I move, the question became that you have an opportunity there where in your job you would actually be able to get a lot of the satisfaction that you're trying to get outside your job. So if you can marry the two parts of your life together where your job itself is about making a difference in something big, it became harder and harder to not consider it. And then when I started talking to people over here, and when I came and visited you, you realize that they're serious about it. It is not something they're just writing and putting in a drawer, so they're probably not perfect, but at least they got that little subtle differentiation between saying, I want to be number one, and if I'm number one, I'm obviously going to do something good for the world. That's what most people would say. This was slightly reversed. They said, I want to do something good for the world, and to be able to do that, I need to be really, really good at what I do. And for me, that subtle reversal was what tipped the discussion. Now you're saying the move, it was actually a huge move. And thinking of it, I keep telling people this is a bigger move than the move I made when I was younger and came from Egypt to Canada. It is a different world. It is a different world, and the weather makes a huge difference in everything. When you walk around the streets here, the structure of the houses, the fact that houses have balconies and they have stairs that are open to the air, you'd never see something like this to Ottawa. The fact that you're sitting in your office and you can open the windows, that doesn't happen. Everything there is designed to be slammed shut just so you don't freeze to death. So it is a huge difference. I find it much, much more similar to my own roots in the Middle East than to Ottawa from a style perspective, and it's actually a beautiful city, beautiful campus. I love it, but still, it's hard when you've lived in one place for such a long time.
Right. Now, you are currently leading the Faculty of Applied Science, together with 11 engineering programs, along with three schools, architecture and landscape architecture, nursing, and the School of Engineering at the Okanagan campus. What types of challenges do you face in leading such a diverse spectrum of disciplines within one faculty?
Well, it is a challenge, and the challenge is, in my opinion, at least, the is at the same time the opportunity for the strength of the faculty. I don't believe there would be any other faculty. There definitely is no other faculty in Canada that would have nursing and engineering together. Engineering and architecture together, and landscape architecture is not so out of this world. It's not the norm, but it is not unheard of. Having nursing with them is the part that is quite unusual. And engineering here at UBC is a whole lot broader in its spectrum than in many other faculties of engineering. So you're 100% right that the diversity is huge. But when you look at it, when you have all those people together in the same place or in the same unit, then it makes it much easier to connect with one another. And you have opportunities that you would not get in some of the other universities or campuses, when it's a lot more complex to cross over into some other faculty and find out who's there. So one of the things I'm consciously trying to do over here is to simply get people to talk to each other a little bit more. And typically, once they realize that the other side exists and there is actually opportunities for people to engage with one another, they themselves come up with what they want to do together that would give them a bit of a unique feature and advantage that would help them differentiate the type of work they do here from the type of work they would do at another campus where there is no such diversity. So it's not a question of forcing people to work together or ensuring that everybody works with everybody, because that's not right and it's not logical, but just letting people know who else exists with them in this house, so that it's no longer just we're all living in one house and we're renting rooms separately, that you start to actually make it into a home. So not everybody has to talk to everybody every minute of the day, but knowing that there is somebody else in that other room that actually can connect with you. So if I'm in engineering and I'm working on some medical application, I know there are nurses down the street that there is more affinity with them than if they were in a completely other discipline. So I'm hoping to get people to have the opportunities to talk to each other, and it's already starting to make a difference where they connect with themselves once they know that this is encouraged and they start to get exposed to what the other side is doing. It just picks up on its own.
Now, practically, let's say if you're a student in, say, civil engineering, studying, say, structural design, and you want to also learn about architecture, is there a possibility within the faculty where a student could take a course in another area, or do you envision something like that in the future?
I mean, you've done your homework. that's a perfect example. That is a perfect example. And I think, as is now, they are starting to. There are two professors in architecture that have been hired recently with engineering degrees background. One of them has been here for, like, one is just starting, but the other one has been here for a while. And it is a joint appointment between architecture and civil engineering. And we are gradually starting to create joint projects, if you want, so that the students in architecture will still work on architectural stuff and the students in engineering will still work on the engineering aspect. But at the end of the day, when they graduate, they both work together on the same building. So the idea is to try and simulate the environment that they would work in, where you pose a problem that covers both aspects, and then you put a team together with people from here and people from there and get them to connect with one another and address the whole problem in a holistic way. So most definitely in architecture and civil engineering, there are links. We are looking at energy, for example, now as a theme that crosses all the disciplines in the faculty, except for nursing. It's the one that, at least to my knowledge, they're not doing specific work on that. But architecture, for example, is quite involved in issues of the design of the building in the first place to make it energy efficient. The people in chemical engineering are working on bioenergy aspects. The people in mechanical engineering are working on other aspects of it, electrical engineering. Everybody's doing something different, but they're all working towards the same thing. And we're trying to come up with a strategy that connects all the different aspects together so that we are talking to each other and coming in with a solution that does not just focus on one small part without looking at the big picture that is there. So the example you brought up with architecture is effectively perfect. And we have connections between electrical and mechanical and chemical. So we're trying to build those synergies wherever they make sense.
Yeah, this sort of leads me to the next question I had, is that there are still misconceptions within engineering, just engineering, for example, as sort of one big entity. I mean, since all areas within engineering apply mathematics and physics, but the reality is that each concentration is so extremely specialized. For example, a seismic engineer speaks a very different language than, say, an electrical engineer such as yourself. Yeah. How do engineers attempt to make those interdisciplinary connections when engineering has evolved into something so specialized?
I think I like what you say, because sometimes people say, well, you've got the engineers, which is the larger part of the faculty, and then you have architecture and landscape architecture and nursing, and the engineers are not uniform. It is not one unit that is just marching to the same beat. The engineers themselves within engineering are quite diverse, and disciplines, like you pointed out, are incredibly different. Like civil engineering, if I get a structural engineer and I get him to talk to a biomedical engineer, for example, the discipline is night and day, but they have a common basics of how do you attack a problem, how do you seek a solution. It is very much like if I were to come in and say all the humanities are the same. Well, they're all humanities. Well, I mean, what's the difference between sociology and anthropology? And this is, it's all the same. Of course, it's not all the same. They have common foundational elements there, but then they evolve in very, very different directions. And the exact same thing happens in engineering. However, when you put it down, you will find it's almost like a spectrum that is gradually changing color, so that not everybody needs to work with everybody else, but there's always links, so that you're not just by yourself someplace. There are others, like mechanical fits very nicely between electrical, civil, and chemical, for example, because they do interact with all of them. You would go in mining and you will find them doing things on geothermal energy that could very well fit within mechanical. You'll find the people that work in biomedical, they can very easily float between a couple of different departments. So there are interfaces between the disciplines that connect them to one another. But there are certain things that are hardcore electrical that the chemical person is not going to have any interest in getting involved in at all. But there will be others where there would be linkages. So it's more like an ongoing chain, and it's not just a linear one. It interconnects in many different ways. And I think, again, the advantage is trying to get these people to know that the others exist, and that sometimes in a place as big as applied science at UBC might be a challenge in itself. The numbers are really large. So you might be working in the faculty and you'd never met another person who works in the same field in another department. So the hope is that we are gradually picking up the cross-cutting themes and making sure that people know what the others are doing. And that's the only thing that the faculty can do. I mean, faculty from a central perspective cannot go and do the research. The professors are the ones doing that. You cannot direct everything they do every day. But what you can do is look at the common elements between the different departments and then bring that back to them and says, did you know there are other people in this area that are doing that? And when I came here, I started going around the departments to visit each one of them to find out what they are doing. And that was the first thing that struck me, that there is a lot of things that are happening in different places that are very common in what they are, at least in the problem they are addressing. And energy was one of the issues that came up. And we simply basically sent an email to people and said, we're going to have this meeting in there. If you're doing any work related to anything related to energy, come on up. And very large numbers showed up, and some of them were not aware that there was that many in there. And it's picking up momentum, and the connections are starting. So I see our role from a faculty perspective as simply trying to get people together and identify the opportunities where they can work together. If there is not an opportunity to work together on a certain subject, go ahead and work on your own core discipline by yourself. That's more than valid and more than valued. But when there is an opportunity to connect with the others, sometimes it's easier for the ones a bit at a distance to see the similarities and then come back and say, you know, there's an opportunity coming up, and if you guys got together, it might work a little bit better than if you do it individually.
Well, I'd like to ask a little bit about your research, and I thought I'd first ask you what digital or adaptive signal processing is.
I'm watching the screen behind you, and it actually has a lot to do with what you're doing over here in this. Yeah. Signals are anything in the world is a signal. So your speech now, my speech, is a signal. It's basically the volume of the sound that is coming out and how it changes with time. That's a signal, and it very much depends on what you are saying and who you are. So it will depend on the mechanism that generates that, on your own throat and your own vocal system as a whole. It will also depend on what you are trying to say. That will make the signal that comes out when you speak at a certain minute different from what comes out later, and it will make it different from mine. Signal can also apply to the stock market exchange. When you look at the values of the prices, that's a signal. So anything that changes as a function of an independent variable is a signal. Images are signals, except that they're now a function of two directions and dimensions instead of one. So my own work works with signals that can be represented in a digital form. So at the end of the day, instead of you choosing the volume on a continuous level, you basically, it's either a one or a zero. So once I take your speech, if I can change that into a format that is just a bunch of discrete values that are specified, then it becomes a digital signal. And then I start to work with it using a computer, which is the only difference, as opposed to using some other form of manipulating it. So when you talk about digital signal processing, the processing part comes in where, give me a signal that has been recorded in some kind of a digital format, and then I need to process it to do something. And that something depends on your own application. So I need to extract some information from it. For an example, if you give me a bunch of database of faces and I'm trying to identify a person in that database, that's a form of it. If you give me a telephone communication channel that has a lot of noise on it when you speak on the phone here and it's going to go to some other person quite a distance away, that signal is traveling along the wires that you're sending and picking up a lot of garbage along the way. When you hear it on the other end, you're not hearing the signal as it is received. It has been cleaned up quite a bit for you. So we receive the signal, you try and differentiate what is the original content of it and what is the noise and the garbage that is picked up, so that you can take that out and reproduce the original signal as best as you can. That's signal processing. When you look at your iPod and the fact that you can pack the number of songs that you have on it. They basically take the song and then try and extract the basic fundamental information in it that you hear as a human being and cut out all the other stuff so that I don't need to save it if you're not going to know the difference. So what you're listening to is actually not the same quality signal that was recorded. There is a lot that got removed out of it to reduce the space that it is using in the memory. The trick is to do it in an intelligent way so that what you remove, your ear cannot hear it. The computer will certainly be able to tell the difference between the two signals, but your ear can't. So if you're the one who's intended to use it, why bother save all the information? So it becomes, again, a question of give me the digital information and I'm going to process it in a way so that I will extract only the part that is necessary for the human ear to hear it and not be able to tell the difference, and the rest of the stuff I'm going to throw it away. And that allows me to save it in a compact way. So applications are quite varied, and like one of the things that I was working on in Ottawa right before I came, which I'm having a really hard time keeping up with now, is again applications of signal processing to hearing aids, because they like now hearing aids are quite smart. So instead of you having a hearing aid that an old person is going to have to take off and start fooling around, how much volume do they want? Do they want to put in some noise cancellation to clean the signal? And it's quite complicated to get someone to sit and try and adjust something that has four controls on it to get the best one. And then as soon as you adjust it, you leave the room and you move onto the street, for example, and then you need a different setting for the whole thing. So the way it works with hearing aids now is that you try and pick up the signal. There are microphones on it. You pick up the signal, and there is an intelligent algorithm in there that gets the hearing aid based on the signal it received to figure out where is it. Is it in a concert hall where you need that type of adjustment to the signal, or are you in a traffic on the street with things, horns blowing, or are you in a party with a lot of people? So it decides on which environment it is in, and then it decides on the best cleanup needed for the signal so that they would set it up in a way so that that particular person with their particular hearing impairment receives the best signal possible for them to hear it, so that they don't have to sit and adjust the controls. It is done automatically for them. The hearing aid knows what the profile of the hearing impaired person is. They know which environment they're in, and it can figure out what is the best way to treat that signal to provide him with the best hearing signal possible. So it's basically digital signal processing is a way of manipulating signals that have been stored in a digital format to provide them in a better form that you can use for something else that you want.
Where is the research really heading to? Is it towards all the areas you mentioned, or what's sort of the latest innovation in this area right now, or where's the excitement right now?
I think from my perspective, the hearing aid project is one that we started recently, and it's one that I personally connect. I mean, it was nice to know that you can see directly the application of what you are doing. So there is a whole broad spectrum of innovation in that, given that you can do more and more now with the algorithms you have. And hearing aid has an additional problem on it, is that you can't afford to have it. The hardware that you're going to use to do what you want to do has to fit in a person's ear. So that puts massive constraints on you. And the microphones, you have two or three microphones over there. They are very, very closely spaced to one another. This is not a microphone like the one we are using here. So there are a lot of hardware challenges that force you to squeeze everything you're trying to do into the smallest space possible, and you have to do that in a way that is probably not as visible. You don't want people walking around with big equipment on their heads. But the temptation is that you can do more and more now. You know that you can have a chip that will do more of that stuff. So how much can you pack to get it to do fancier stuff without coming to the point of it not being too big to be used by the person? Like, one of the bigger things is, how do you get the two ears to talk to each other? Like, if you have two hearing aids on the two ears, you want to be able to transfer the information from one to the other, and that would resolve a lot of issues. But again, it's not that easy to pass the information at a fast rate from one ear to the other like that.
Well, I just want to ask you one last question, a sort of small snapshot of the day in the life of a dean.
And that's going to be very short. You wake up early, you come to work, and you work till you drop, and that's it. It has been hard. No, it's It's fun. I think the hardest part is that you talk to, you end up meeting a lot of people and talking to a lot of people, and you come at the end of the day and you haven't had a chance to sit down and follow up on any of the stuff that you've been talking about. So you end up spending your evening doing what you should have been doing during the day. But I think it gives me the opportunity to meet everybody on campus effectively. I keep discovering that the more people I haven't met, so...
Now, you're wanting to continue a partnership with your former university in some way. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, typically as a professor, when you move from one place to the other, you have to finish the commitment to the students that you have over there. So before coming here, I've made arrangements so that they all have co-supervisors there, but I still try and go back once a month to meet with the students until they finish. I certainly will not be taking new students in Ottawa, right. but I do have the moral commitment to finish the work with them.
Right. And are you supervising any students here at the moment?
I have not started yet. There is one that has just applied that wants to come in September, but this is like all my students are currently in Ottawa.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful, just a wonderful privilege to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
And
thank
I wish you the best of luck with your faculty.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having done such a good homework on this. You know all about engineering now. Thanks a lot.
That was Dean of Applied Science, Dr. Taysir Abu Nasser.
I used to think that I could not go on, and life was nothing but an awful song. But now I know the meaning of true love, leaning on the everlasting arms. If I can see it, then I can do it. If I just believe it, there's nothing to it. I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I think about it every night and day. Spread my wings and fly away. I believe I can soar. I see me running through that open door. I believe I can fly. I believe I can fly. See, I was on the verge of breaking down. Sometimes silence can seem so loud. There are miracles in life I must achieve, but first I know it starts inside of me. Oh, oh, if I can see it, then I can be it. If I just believe it, there's nothing to it. I believe I can fly.
You're listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. This week is UBC Research Week, showcasing research and cutting-edge work that UBC faculties and departments and schools have to offer. The full schedule of events can be found on www.celebrateresearch.ubc.ca. Some key events organized by the Faculty of Applied Science include today's series of presentations put on by the School of Nursing titled A Wealth of Knowledge and Experience, Research Partnerships in the Downtown East Side. This event will be held today between 2 and 5 p.m. at the Raycam Cooperative Center. This Wednesday, March 11th, two key engineering events include a lecture by Professor Vikram Krishnamurthy titled Biological Ion Channels at Nano and Macro Scales, an Electrical Engineer's Perspective, held in the Kaiser Building on the main campus at 11 a.m., as well as another lecture by Professor Carlos Ventura from the Department of Civil Engineering titled Learning from Earthquakes to Prepare for Earthquakes, also held in the Kaiser Building at 3:30. Professor Tara Lee from the Department of English will be my guest next week discussing her research of minority Canadian literature, as well as answering the question, what can you do with an English degree besides teach? If you would like to get in touch with us, you can do so by email at proftalk@gmail.com. And for an updated schedule of future shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And you can hear the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for tuning in this morning.